Yesterday we were talking about the reform movement. We're not finished with the reform. When we get to America, we're going to look at it some more. There's a lot more interesting things to say about it. But at least in Europe, I want to look at the Orthodox reaction to the reform movement, which is very, very significant because it says a lot about how the Orthodox world has been reacting to the reform movement ever since. I mentioned yesterday it's important to focus on that the reform movement goes on the offensive against the Orthodox. The major attack is focused on the city of Frankfurt on Main. Okay, remember one of the earliest Jewish communities, one of the communities destroyed in the Crusades. That's where they basically seize control of all the Jewish institutions, you know, ban the teaching of Torah. We're talking about a real, you know, culture conflict here, a real culture war between the assimilationists versus the traditionalists. The major person, character involved from the traditional Jewish side is a man who is very significant to us. His name is Samson Raphael Hirsch. You guys all have heard of Hirsch? There's the Breuer family descended from the Hirsches. Very significant character at this period of time. Hirsch himself, in his dates, he's born 1808 to 1888. He lived to the ripe old age of 80 years old. He was born in Hamburg, and he is very well educated. Man, graduate of the University of Bonn. He was a member of the Austro-Hungarian Parliament. In 1851, he left his position as chief rabbi of Moravia and moves to Frankfurt with the idea of philosophically leading the counterattack against the reform movement. We're not talking about like he organized barricades and the, you know, clubs and street fighting here. We're talking about someone who's trying to move in just as Rav Sadia Gaon did. We're talking about going back to the 10th century against the Karaites. So Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch is trying to do the same thing philosophically to counter the attacks of the reform movement. This idea that modernity should be accepted at the expense of Torah. Modern. Modernity means modern, like the modern world. He fights and wins the right to set up his own Orthodox institution in Frankfurt, which is called the Klal Agudat Yisrael, and he created his own religious school system. And he also brought into the modern Jewish world a certain philosophy, which we call, it's called Torah and Derech Eretz. And I want to read a little bit of, if you want to read what Hirsch says, by the way, he writes, there's an excellent book on the mitzvot called Horeb. Guys, it's going to come out on the tape if you do that. Called Horeb, which is an explanation of the mitzvot. I highly recommend, if you want to read a really interesting summary of what's going on in the Jewish world in Germany at the time, read the introduction to Horeb. There's copies floating around yeshiva everywhere. He talks about what's going on with Reform and the Orthodox in Germany at the time, in the 19th century. Very, very interesting. But this is from an article written by Hirsch, a letter he wrote called Religion Allied to Progress. 1854. He says, now what is it that we want? Are the only alternatives either to abandon religion or to renounce all progress? We declare before heaven and earth that if our religion demanded that we should renounce what is called civilization and progress, we would obey unquestioningly, because our religion is for us the word of God before which every other consideration has to give way. It's a pretty heavy statement there. Well, you can see the difference between what he's saying and someone like Moses Mendelssohn. Rational thought, everything makes sense. Then he goes on to say, however, there is, however, no such dilemma. Judaism never remained aloof from true civilization and progress. In almost every area, its adherents were fully abreast of contemporary learning and very often excelled their contemporaries. An excellent thing is the study of Torah combined with the ways of the world. That's Torah and Derech Eretz, Torah and the ways of the world. In truth, if only most Jews were truly Jews, most of the factors would disappear, which today bar many an avenue of activity to them. And what he's saying is essentially a very true historical statement, that Judaism has always been, if you know the history of, you know, we mentioned this, medieval Europe and Jews involved in sciences and mathematics and in trades, and the normal Jewish way to be is to be in the world, fully in the world, but to be fully immersed in Torah. And that, of course, the question here is not an either or, it's a question of priorities. Okay, and Hirsch is making it very clear, the first priority is Torah. Unlike a guy like Mendelssohn, Hirsch would say, if it doesn't make sense to you, do it anyway. I mean, once you come to the intellectual decision that God gave Torah, okay, you don't understand a certain mitzvah, well, you know, I'm not keeping that. That's not a Jewish idea. Okay, the point is a very significant point here. We are supreme rationalists, and there should be no problem here between science and Torah and between being in the world. The problem is a question of priorities. So he introduced the philosophy, which is going to be a very powerful philosophy in modern Jewish history. I would say to a large extent it has been adopted by the modern Orthodox world, the motto of Yeshiva University is not Torah and Derech Eretz, it's Torah Umada, Torah and Science. But it's based on an attempt to try and synthesize a modern religious Jew who can deal with the world around him and the diaspora, yet remain loyal to Torah. And by no means is that easy to do. Both my personal experience and looking at the statistics, I know that the modern Orthodox world in America and England has a lot of problems in terms of assimilation, and because it's a difficult thing to do. I know many kids who, in keeping with the philosophy of being religious Jews yet fully in the world, go off to university, and the attrition rate is horrible for even kids brought up in day school backgrounds. It's a very difficult thing. I'm not attacking modern Orthodoxy. I'm just saying that the difficulty of trying to synthesize a new modern Jew who is doing both, we see is not easy. Okay? And a lot of the Jewish world has decided to more or less turn their backs, not on modernity, but not like, I'm not talking about the Pennsylvania Dutch here, you know, we're not going to have electricity in our house, but more or less to reject the trappings of modernity and the educational system that goes along with it out of fear that it will drag their kids out of Torah lifestyle, which is a very realistic fear, and end up having them secular. It's a big problem. The problem that's going on in Germany in the early and mid-19th century is very clearly been perpetuated in the Jewish world today, and I haven't seen any easy solution to it. As the Jewish world becomes more factionalized and in many ways more extreme, it remains one of the big challenges we have to deal with. And what Hirsch is so relevant is he's a person who is totally loyal to Torah. He is a good role model. If you wonder, and his commentary is so relevant to us. He has a brilliant commentary. He's a fantastic writer, very poetic, high German, just like Mendelssohn. I'm mentioning all these German Jewish scholars. Mendelssohn wrote a translation of the Bible into German, which until today is considered a real work of art, you know, along with, of course, our good friend Martin Luther. But Hirsch's commentary is very fitting for us to read. It's not cheap. It's a great investment. He does the weekly Torah portion because many of the issues in the commentary relates to the problems we have today. So it's worthwhile reading that on your own. Yeah. No, there are no.
How are you raising your kids?
I'm not saying on tape I'm raising my kids. If you want to ask me after, I'll tell you. One thing I know. I just have a gun and a whip, you know. One thing I know Americans hate to hear this, but there are no simple solutions to complex problems. Okay, there aren't, unfortunately. Okay, but one thing is for sure, one thing I can say, is to the extent that the entire Jewish people is unified and trying to keep Torah, it makes that a lot easier for us to do. The problem for the Jewish world today is not so much to be like the Gentiles, as to be like the Jews who are assimilated. When you're trying to raise your kids as traditional Jews in an environment, in an assimilated Jewish environment, is very difficult. Okay, so we all need to work on raising our level of observance wherever we're at and bringing the whole community with us. Because one thing's for sure, the other thing for sure is we can't do it individually. Every Jew is a cell in a big body, and we all have to do that together. So that's why Kiruv is so important in outreach. The other response, which is also very important to understand, is the response of the Chasam Sofer, who's Rabbi Moses Schreiber, who's 1762 to 1839. He dies like 41 years before Hirsch, but he is living towards the end of his life, precisely at the rise of Reform Judaism in Germany. And having been born in Frankfurt, however, moved to Pressburg in 1806. He sets up a yeshiva, a very modern yeshiva, the Pressburg Yeshiva, and modern meaning, not in terms of the accoutrements, but in terms of the curriculum, etc. We're going to talk more today about yeshivot and the establishment of the yeshiva system in Europe. But the Chasam Sofer, Chatam Sofer, everyone pronounce his name, is his worldview is much more conservative. Okay, the famous quote of the Chatam Sofer that everyone likes to quote is Chadash min haTorah Aser. You want to translate that for me? Chadash, new, not the Communist Party in Israel. Chadash min haTorah, from the Torah, Asur, is forbidden. Now, he's not saying that, you know, we invent electricity, we can't use it in our houses. He's saying that any alterations to traditional Jewish observance or prayer or ritual not sanctioned by mainstream religious Jewish rabbinate is not allowed. Okay? And we're going to see that and why is he attacking that specifically? Because by making these minor little alterations, like I said, poking a little hole in the dam leads to a big crack that opens a floodgate. I want to read you, this is the letter from the Chasam Sofer. And it's very interesting what he says. He says, do not touch the books of Rabbi Moses. He calls him Rabbi Moses. He's talking Moses who? Mendelssohn of Dessau, he says. And your foot will never slip. Never say, times have changed. This is not a lyric from Bob Dylan. We have an old father who has never changed and will never change. The order of prayer and synagogue shall remain forever as it has been up till now, and no one may presume to change anything of its structure. Now, this opinion is very much in keeping with, I would say, the modern Haredi, and this is kind of an oxymoron, but the Haredi view of the world, which is a much more reactionary opinion. Now, not that Hirsch isn't a compromise. You can see clearly he's not. But it's a much more, I would say, isolationist view of how the Jews should look at the world. And there's definitely a legitimacy to this idea. And we see in hindsight the tremendous difficulty involved in trying to synthesize modernity with Torah lifestyle. There are definitely problems with isolation, for sure. I'm not attacking the Haredi world either here. Far be it from me. But we see that this is another way of dealing with the situation, which has become, to a very significant extent, the reaction of the ultra-Orthodox community in the land of Israel, and is now, by the way, catching on very big in America, okay, which is to go much more to the right, so to speak. When I say right, I don't mean politically, but to rejection of modernity with all its trappings. So the point now, we're in Jerusalem, for instance, there is a cherem on Limudei Chol, meaning you can't teach secular studies of any kind in Jerusalem in any Haredi schools. I mean secular studies besides reading, writing, and arithmetic. No, you know, not teaching biology, and not teaching, you know, advanced mathematics, certainly not teaching British literature and stuff like that. Now this, of course, is not, we should know, historically, the way the Jewish world has reacted to the outside world. But it is a reaction. It is a reaction. The insular way the ultra-Orthodox world reacts today, and we have to appreciate that great Golda Meir line that she uses. I don't agree with it 100%, but it's a very telling point. She said, I can forgive the Arabs for killing Jews, but I can't forgive the Arabs for making us kill them. Because by having to make this militant sort of macho Jew who has to take a gun and kill people, it's not the Jewish nature. It bothers, and I understand where she's coming from with that sentence, because it bothers me much more the way the Jewish world is today and the reactionary mentality of much of the religious, the Haredi world. It comes from a reaction, and if the attack had never begun in the first place, the Orthodox world would not have evolved the way it has evolved. Okay? We would have had probably a little more mellow, let's say, view of the rest of the world. And it's very sad. It's a very sad statement, and this has much more to do with the internal problems of the Jewish people than dealing with the external world and the Gentiles and that. That's not the real challenge. The real challenge is the Jewish world, how we deal with each other. And again, I'm not proposing solutions here. The one thing I am saying is we've got to have tolerance. That is for sure very important. Okay? And tolerance doesn't mean we accept everyone's point of view. That is not what I'm saying either. But people have to respect each other and have a civil dialogue. You know, if it gets violent, God forbid, we have to remember we're all part of a whole. The Jewish people is one entity. Okay, enough of my personal worldview. I want to jump and look a little bit more at the world at large, because it's not just a question of internal problems in the Jewish people and reform schism breaking away from Orthodoxy. There is definitely a significant percentage of Jews, primarily in Western Europe, but not exclusively, who are going to be sucked totally into the Gentile world. Because they feel now that the gates of the ghetto have been opened, the Jews pour out into the streets, many Jews are going to view the solution to anti-Semitism is going to be assimilation. Which is a huge mistake, by the way, of course. It doesn't lead. The biggest anti-Semitic outbreaks in human history have taken place in those communities where the Jews have been most comfortable and most assimilated, most notably, of course, being Nazi Germany. But you're going to have a lot of assimilation. We have whole communities basically leaving Torah. Whole communities leaving Torah. The Sephardic community of France after Napoleon almost all assimilate. Okay, the Jewish communities in Germany and in Italy mostly go. Not completely, but the majority of the Jews leave. Some stay in Reform, and some go all the way out completely. And that's, by the way, similar, or even to the situation American Jews in today. People don't realize that over half American Jews are not affiliated with any movement whatsoever, just completely assimilated. And any Jewish affiliation of any kind is better than no Jewish affiliation. It makes a statement about where your priorities are. And unfortunately, in Europe, we see that a lot of Jews just opt out. A quarter of a million Jews are going to convert out of Judaism in the 19th century. Quarter of a million. Now, you know the largest number, the three largest areas, Russia, Poland, interesting, I'll explain in a minute why. Not because that was where the assimilation was so great, but because that's where there's so many Jews. Russia, Poland, Austria, the England, and German states. Germany's not really a country until Bismarck, you know, 1870s. 90,000 Jews in Poland, Russia area convert. Now, again, that's a very small percentage, actually, the total Jewish population of somewhere near 5 million Jews living in that part of the world. But we do have assimilation there. But the actual, even though the numbers are smaller in Western Europe, the actual percentages are much higher. Why? Because in Western Europe, where the Gentiles are more genteel and nice, the attraction is going to be much greater. In cultured cities like Warsaw in Poland, obviously is going to be a big draw home for Jews to assimilate to. So you have it everywhere, but much more intensely in Western Europe. Now, why do Jews convert? Jews are going to convert. I think I mentioned this previously. Jews don't convert. You know, today it's interesting. Today you have Jews who are looking for spirituality, who can become, unfortunately, Jews for Jesus and Jews for Hare Krishna and Jews for transcendental meditation and Jews for everything you could think of out of a genuine desire for spirituality, albeit they go in the wrong direction. Jews in the 19th century in Europe, which is a very non-spiritual time in Western Europe, we're talking about, right, the Age of Enlightenment, a lot of assimilation, a lot of anti-religious sentiment, the explosion of science. When Darwin comes in the late 1850s, that's going to be used as a weapon to attack religion, like, unbelievably. Not that Darwin was anti-religious. He wasn't. Okay, that's not true. Not a fair statement about him. Jews assimilating or converting do it not out of religious desire. They do it as a way to be fully integrated into Gentile society. Okay, reform, I can drop all the barriers. Assimilate, I don't have to keep anything whatsoever. I don't have to affiliate myself with the Jewish community. But if I become a Christian, then I will actually be totally accepted by society. I can join their country clubs. I can take an oath in their Bible. There's many places I mentioned. Lionel Rothschild, right, the first Jewish lord, had to refuse to take the oaths of the House of Lords because on a Christian Bible. If I become a Christian, I have no problem swearing using JC's name. Now, and some of these people, when they convert, become very, very big people in European culture. I mentioned already Benjamin Disraeli, 1804 to 1881, who, as twice Prime Minister of England, I mentioned one of the great reforming Prime Minister under Queen Victoria, the height of British power, okay? Karl Marx, 1818 to 1883, who was, I believe his family converted him at a very young age to Protestantism. And Marx is the founder of one of the most significant, albeit now in hindsight, failed economic experiments of the last 200 years, communism, Das Kapital. Now here's a guy who has a very ambivalent relationship with Judaism. On one hand, he's always talking about religion being the opiate of the masses. Okay, that's his famous quote. I remember in Moscow they had a big statue with Marx, and it says religion is the opiate of the masses, you know. But on the other hand, he wasn't anti-Semite, Marx. But definitely interesting reaction to his own people. The irony, of course, of Karl Marx is that he later is known as the Moses of the working man, and Das Kapital was called the Bible of the working man. So that he who was so anti-organized religion has all these titles associated with, like, messianic, you know, economic. He's one of the many Jews who is, or Jews of people of Jewish descent. He himself was definitely Jewish, who's going to create a social movement, a misguided Jew trying to create with sort of messianic aspirations, albeit totally in the wrong direction that we now see it failed. But a very influential person in modern economic development of the world. Heinrich Heine, 1797 to 1856, one of the greatest figures in 19th century German literature. He said, by the way, I want to read you a quote. This is from an article he wrote in 1823. Another person with very, very ambivalent feelings about Judaism. Very real interesting love-hate relationship Heine had. But he says it perfectly. This is from 1823, a ticket of admission to European culture. And I quote, "From the nature of my thinking, you can determine that baptism is a matter of indifference to me. And I do not regard it as important, even symbolically. My becoming a Christian is the ticket of admission to European culture." Okay, so these are people who are making a conscious decision. Unlike those of us today who were raised secular, it was not a conscious decision. That's the way we were raised. For our grandparents in America, it was their ticket to becoming fully acculturated into American civilization and not starving to death, having to work on Sabbath. But it's more or less the same idea. There was a whole generation of Jews in Europe who made a conscious decision to enter Gentile society, either by assimilating or going all the way and converting, not out of religious fervor. So that's what's going on in Western Europe. We have a big decline in Jewish observance. Assimilation, conversion, reform movement, bad news. To jump across to Eastern Europe, Eastern Europe is a very different situation. You don't have an enlightenment in Eastern Europe. Napoleon makes it. Right? All the way, the Battle of Borodino. You know, the Russians abandon Moscow and it's burned. And, of course, then Napoleon loses his whole army and retreats back to France. So although he physically makes it, the Napoleonic Enlightenment influence that was so prevalent throughout Western Europe does not come to Russia. Russia is going to be a very backward country. The serfs, I'm not talking about black guys, you know, people of color as they call them today, but the average Russian was legally a slave of the nobility until the same time as America's fighting the Civil War, until 1861, I believe, is when the Tsar emancipates the serfs. We're talking about a real feudal system. We're talking about a people who is far more primitive economically. The Eastern Orthodox Church of Russia, you just go in these churches. You know, when I was a student in Moscow, it's the only thing you could see in Russia, even though they were mostly turned into stables and movie theaters and everything, although during the communist era, but they just have a feeling of, they're eerie. You get the real heebie-jeebies. After the Khmelnytsky massacres, to jump back in time, the situation for Jews in Poland takes a big dive down. Okay, we have 100,000 Jews killed, hundreds of communities destroyed. Those Jews who weren't killed wander around. Literally, Jews starve to death. I mean, communities destroyed. The economic infrastructure of the Jewish community is devastated. Now, we still have hundreds of thousands of Jews living in Poland, but it never returns to this golden age. And not only that, we see that in the 18th century, from during the reigns of Peter the Great, who was one of the most aggressive, in many ways great, but also really, really powerful despotic Russian czars. He ruled from 1672 to 1725, and his successor, Catherine, from 1729 to 1796, Catherine the Great, Russia expands. Peter the Great, who builds St. Petersburg, he wants to bring Russia out of its sort of feudal Eastern orientation into a much more Western. His idea was to build. He builds this artificial capital of Russia called St. Petersburg, later called Leningrad, now called St. Petersburg again, built primarily on swamps up there in the north. He wants to, it's a way of physically, by sheer will, moving Russia westward. If you read Russian literature from the period of time, you'll see, like in War and Peace, what's the language spoken in the Russian court? French. Okay, a lot of these people could barely speak Russian, as a matter of fact. This because France was the dominant culture. Very interesting, the French were already invading Europe at the time, but everyone's speaking French anyway. And as he expands westward, he's going to absorb a lot of territory of what was formerly Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. During the 18th century, much of this is going to be absorbed into Russian sphere of influence. And all the Jews who were formerly in Poland, as Poland's going to be divided up, are going to end up under Russian control. The Russians, therefore, end up with a situation where, as formerly, they didn't have a lot of Jews. They now inherit a huge number of Jews. The statistic was, I remember what the number of Jews living in Russia, but it's well over, in the 19th century, they're going to get something like 1.5 million Jews absorbed into their territory. And unlike other peoples in other monarchs in Jewish history who were happy to use the Jews and abuse them also, but use them. We use them as economic advisors and translators and tax collectors and whatever. The Russians seem to have no interest in their history in doing anything positive with the Jews except making their lives miserable so they'll leave. And we have a series of decrees in Russia which is going to end up totally isolating and impoverishing of what is the largest Jewish community in the world. Beginning in 1795, Tsar Paul I sets up the Pale of Jewish Settlement, which is basically creates a giant ghetto in what is much of Ukraine and Belarusia. And it's going to grow and grow and grow. And it's a series of pieces of legislation between 1795 and 1835. The Pale gets larger and larger and larger. It eventually is going to encompass 386,000 square miles of territory. Huge, huge. By the end of the 19th century, we're going to have something like 5 million Jews. About 40% of the world's Jewish population is going to be in the world's largest ghetto. And there's severe restrictions on what Jews can do. They're not allowed out of that ghetto without permission. Jews were not allowed to settle in most parts of Russia. They were closed to Jews. You could only leave the Pale with special permission. The economic opportunities in the Pale are extremely, extremely limited. So the situation for the Jews is very, very bad. One of the things the Russians do is bar the Jews from the production and sale of alcohol, which, as I mentioned previously, was one of the major sources of income. They're certainly not going to be used as tax collectors by the Russian Tsar. By the way, many Jews, when you see Jews taking last names, most of it in Ashkenazic world takes place at this time, because the Russians, to keep track of the Jews to tax them, need to have last names for them. When your name is Jacob ben Avram, you know, who's that? It's like 25,000 Jacob ben Avrams living in the Pale, you know? So a lot of this idea of giving Jews the last names is going to come out of the Gentile desire to be able to keep track of the Jews, tax them for census purposes, whatever. Because economic opportunities are so incredibly limited, and Jews are not allowed to do virtually anything, the entire community is going to become very impoverished, and between 15 and 30% of the community is going to be absolutely no source of income. We're talking about welfare cases. And it's very interesting. If you study the period of time, you want to see a great view of the incredibly sophisticated social welfare system of the Jews historically. You look at Eastern Europe at this time, and you realize that despite the awesome level of poverty of the entire community and the complete impoverization of at least a quarter of the community, it was an incredibly well-developed system of social welfare. You don't have Jews starving to death. Okay, as a matter of fact, during this period of time, The rabbis issued a decree in the 18th century against accepting any converts to Judaism from like the Polish population. Like no Pole. Again, the Poles hated the Jews. Why would a Pole convert to Judaism? Because all the Polish peasants realized that no Jew ever starved to death in the street. Whereas if you're a Polish peasant, you could easily starve to death in the street because no one's going to take care of you. The government wasn't going to do it. The church wasn't going to do it. You actually had people converting to Judaism, despite the fact that you'd be put to death. You'd certainly be beaten to death by your neighbors and Polish neighbors. People were so desperate. It's a question of risking being killed for converting to Judaism or starving to death for sure. I'll go for it. And the rabbis didn't want people being flooded by, you know, thousands of Polish insincere converts who are trying to save their lives by becoming Jews and benefiting from the Jewish social welfare system. Very similar to the fear taking place in Israel today that because Israel has a law of return, everyone and his mother is going to claim a descendancy from Jews and come from all of these impoverished third world countries like Russia now and swamp the land of Israel because we take care of our own. It's a very interesting phenomenon in Jewish history. Okay. So you have economic restrictions, impoverization of the community, and also a lot of forced assimilation, by the way. The Tsarist government was very into either getting the Jews out or getting the Jews to just not be Jewish anymore. And they have the backing of a group of Jews we're going to look at in a few minutes called the Maskilim. There's definitely, just as in Western Europe, you have a population of Jews who are openly into getting the larger Jewish population into modernity, albeit even has to be done forcibly by dropping Judaism. So too, in Eastern Europe, you will have Jews. This is a repeat of the Maccabees. Okay, you'll have Jews who have a vested interest in trying to get their fellow Jews to drop Judaism and join Russian culture. Okay, the Maskilim were trying to create a culture which was based on synthesizing Jewish culture with Slavic culture. The idea being, just like in Western Europe, if we become more like our Eastern European brethren, we'll study Russian literature, we'll write in Russian, whatever, they'll accept us, and we'll be able to integrate more effectively into society. There's this one guy, Max Lilienthal, between 1815 to 1882. He's actually made by the Russian government, Jewish guy, totally assimilationist, is going to be made the Minister of Jewish Education. And just like there's nothing worse than a Jew who converts to Christianity and wants to debate the rabbis, there's nothing worse than a Jew who wants to out-Gentile the Gentiles in Eastern Europe and show that he can bring his brethren to Slavic culture. And this guy, Max Lilienthal, causes a lot of problems for the Jews. Probably the worst decrees that were introduced against the Jews take place during Nicholas I's time, from 1796 to 1855. He introduces what's called the Cantonist decrees. You heard of the Cantonists? I've met Jewish immigrants in the last decade or so come to Israel who are descendants of Cantonists. Russia had a conscription, as all countries in Europe had, for their army. And Jews, who, by the way, in many periods of time were exempt or actually not allowed. In most countries in the world, in Jewish history, no one wanted Jewish soldiers, even if Jews wanted to be soldiers. And when Jews were allowed to join armies, like in Germany, boy, did they volunteer, because they want to show that they are loyal citizens. During the reign of Nicholas I, he introduces the Cantonist decrees, which require Jewish communities, every community, to supply a certain number of Jewish children. Meaning you could be drafted from age 12, and you have to serve 25 years. I think the range went from between the age of 12 and 25, and you'd be in the army for 25 years. Can you imagine being in the army for 25 years? And we're not talking about the American army, you know, be all that you can be, you know, it's not that kind of thing, you know. They're going to pay your college tuition after, you're going to have a nice life. We're talking about going into some boot camp, eating disgusting food with a bunch of drunken, wife-beating, anti-Semitic, toothless Russian peasants for 25 years. You've got to be kidding. And then, of course, camp conditions were horrible. You should know that, by the way, and more people died in the Civil War because of conditions in the camp and the incredible bloody battles that were fought. Believe me, a lot of people died in the Civil War in battles. This is the history of warfare. Minor wounds, infection, you're dead. Dysentery in camp, you're dead. And not only that, you have to deal with the fact that you're a little Jewish kid with a bunch of incredibly anti-Semitic Polish peasants who would beat you up, who would forcibly convert you. Very few people who went in that situation came out alive. Or if they came out alive, they came out Jewish. It was a death sentence. Okay? So the Jewish community is pushed to the extreme. Physical isolation. Okay, we're talking about economically impoverished, and now they want to draft our kids into the army? Some Jewish parents are so desperate, they actually went and would cut off the right index finger of their sons with a butcher's knife. Can you imagine cutting off your kid's finger with a knife?
Why?
Because if you didn't have an index finger, you couldn't fire a gun and you were exempt from the army. People would try and bribe their way out, and there's a lot of interesting halachic questions. If my kid doesn't go, they've got to take some other Jewish kid. Am I allowed to do that? That's a very problematic thing. We're going to see this in the Holocaust also. This is going to cause okay, lots of problems for the Jews. It's going to raise the level of intensity of pressure on the Jewish community to new extremes. In addition to that, and the last factor we have to throw into here is state-sponsored anti-Semitism. And this is really the worst of everything. Because Jews can tolerate everything except organized oppression of them in the form of violence against Jews. Now, before we look at that, to mention one document which plays a huge part in modern anti-Semitism, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. You heard of this book, The Protocols? It's originally based on a book that appeared in France having nothing to do with the Jews. I read an article a few weeks ago that they actually found the author of this book, a guy who's living in Paris. I don't remember the details of him. But right around the year 1900, this book appears. And the book is supposedly the secret minutes of a meeting that takes place once every 100 years, where the heads of the rabbis and the heads of the UJA, whatever, they get together to plot the next 100 years of Jewish domination of the world. I always tell people, how do you know it's a forgery? Anyone who thinks 10 Jews in a room could agree on anything knows nothing about the Jewish people. Okay? But it is the basis for all of the modern accusations about Jewish world control of the world. There's right-wing groups in America that call the American government ZOG, Zionist Occupation Government. Okay? Now, this book, as outrageous as it sounds, has been one of the biggest sellers in the modern history of, I wouldn't say literature because it's not literature, it's just propaganda. It's the most effective piece of propaganda in human history. It went into dozens and dozens of printings. There are over 80 versions of it in the Arab world. When I was in Russia, I bought a copy. It's the same variation of the theme. It was called Zionism, Enemy of Peace and Social Progress. It's the book which, after the Bible, has more versions of it than any book on the planet Earth. Henry Ford, in the 1920s and 30s, who was a rabid anti-Semite, spent lots of his own money to print this book and disseminate it in America. Ford does not always have a better idea. That's what that proves. So prevalent was the accusation that in 1920, the Times of London called for an official panel of inquiry to investigate it. Not to investigate whether it's true or not. That's the English for you, of course. Just listen to the BBC broadcast about Israel and you realize how biased they are. But last and certainly not least are the actual pogroms. Okay? Because pogroms, meaning that's a word that is not invented to talk about the Jews, but is a word very much associated with Jews. Pogrom is a violent, organized, marching in rows, but generally orchestrated attack against Jewish communities, usually designed as a way of allowing the Gentiles to blow off steam. Now, we see examples of pogroms, so to speak, in the Crusades, the Jewish community of York being destroyed in the late 12th century, okay, or the Jewish community in Germany, when a mob would just come in, find the Jewish community, and slaughter people, or beat people, slaughter, loot, pillage, rape. There are tons and tons of pogroms in Russia prior to the Russian Revolution. The first organized pogrom takes place in Odessa, meaning a big, when I say organized, meaning usually with the collusion of the Russian government. Jews are the classic scapegoats for the economic problems of Russia. That's the reason why the protocols were put out in the first place. They were actually invented by the secret police of the Tsar, the Black 100s, as a way of blaming the Jews for the problems of Russia. The problems with Russia have nothing to do with the Jews. The problems with Russia have to do with a totally backward, feudal, corrupt regime. All you have to do is read Russian literature to see the view of Russian authors about the bureaucracy of Russia. You realize what a mess the country was. But one of the ways of diverting attention was to intellectually blame the Jews through things like the protocols and to allow the masses to blow off steam by taking it out on the Jews, the big punching bags of world history, the Jewish people. So you have a pogrom in Odessa in 1871. After the assassination of Alexander II, who was actually a pretty good czar, even vis-a-vis the Jews, a very into reform, he was murdered by an anarchist through a bomb in his carriage. In 1881, you have huge explosion of pogroms. This is always a reason. You want to celebrate? Kill the Jews. You want to be depressed? Kill the Jews. So you have all these different pogroms. One of the most famous, not because it was the most bloody, but because it took place at a period of time when these things just weren't happening anymore, was in Kishinev. You heard of the Kishinev pogrom? April 6th to 8th in 1903 in Bessarabia during the reign of Nicholas II. There was a huge pogrom which was allowed to just happen for 2 days. And the third day, finally the police went out of the police station and stopped in a few minutes. As soon as the police got involved, these things would end very quickly. But the reason why it was so upsetting was this is supposedly 20th century, the beginning of this millennium here, right? These things just aren't done anymore. The Kishinev pogrom actually got a lot of press in the West, and people were actually quite outraged by it.
Why?
Because it just...
Why the police for a day?
Because the government said, let the people blow off steam, let them kill Jews and rape and pillage for a few days. It's good, they can rape, pillage, take out on them as opposed to us. Russia was full. We're talking about this period of time in 1905, there's an aborted revolution. Russia's on the verge of exploding. Okay? So I want to read a description of the Kishinev pogrom, April 6th to 8th, 1903, from the New York Times, translation of a Russian newspaper article. It is impossible to account the amount of goods destroyed in a few hours. The hurrahs of the rioters and the pitiful cries of the victims filled the air. Wherever a Jew was met, he was savagely beaten into insensibility. One Jew was dragged from a streetcar and beaten until the mob thought he was dead. The air was filled with feathers and torn bedding. Every Jewish household was broken into, and the unfortunate Jews in their terror endeavored to hide in cellars and under roofs. The mob entered the synagogue, desecrated the biggest house of worship, and defiled the scrolls of the law. The conduct of the intelligent Christians was disgraceful. They made no attempt to check the rioting. They simply walked around enjoying the frightful sport. On Tuesday, the third day, when it became known that the troops had received orders to shoot, the rioters ceased. I mean, the Tsar said, okay, now stop it, and it stopped. Between 1903 and 1907, there were 284 pogroms with over 50,000 casualties. We're talking about a level of violence that is unbelievable. And also a series of laws also promulgated against the Jews, making it even more difficult. This is, I want to read, this is Alexander III. This is the May Laws of a series of anti-Jewish legislation. Here's just two of them. It is henceforth forbidden for Jews to settle outside the cities and townships. 2, the registration of property and mortgages in the names of Jews is to be halted temporarily. Jews are also prohibited from administering such properties. 3, it is forbidden for Jews to engage in commerce on Sundays and Christian holidays, and so on and so on. So what we have is economic impoverization, ghettoization, attacks against the Jews, physical attacks against the Jews. The consequences of against the community were devastating. Now, it is a myth, and I hate to shatter one of the great myths, it is a myth that the Eastern European Jewish community was sitting there religious, poor but happy in the shtetl. Now, you did have Jews living in shtetls, for sure, but the community was being devastated, okay, and people were looking for a way to get out of it. Jews were running out of the ghettos and running into all of the anarchist, extremist, communist, socialist, Bundist movements they could find in the hopes that they would be able to change the situation in Russia, Jews being history's great idealists, desperate to find some way of changing the situation. You had all kinds of Jews taking off their kippahs and becoming communists. Okay, we have to shatter that illusion. Now, it is true, you don't have the massive rate of assimilation of Western Europe because, as I said before, Jews have been rich and poor and impoverished and free. It is a much more dangerous situation for Jewish continuity to be rich and free, or wealthy and free in Western Europe. The level of assimilation was much more devastating. But there's certainly a lot of Jews, not for so much economic reasons, but just trying to change the situation, running out of the ghettos and doing all kinds of stuff. And this Haskalah movement I mentioned before was exactly an attempt to create, one of the things was, if we just become more Russian, they'll leave us alone. Out of this Haskalah movement comes the birth of modern, you know, the Yiddish theater, modern Hebrew literature, some of the big personalities that are so venerated when you study in Israeli secular school. These people like Shalom Aleichem, Shalom Rabinowitz, who's the creator of Tevye, the milkman, Fiddler on the Roof, one of the great writers of, and by the way, a lot of these people, you read what they write carefully, their attitude towards the religious Jewish world is extremely negative. We think it's like religious writing because it uses the milieu of the ghetto. But the actual portrayal of the Jewish world is petty and infighting and nasty and overly obsessed with observance. It's not nice. It really isn't. Another big figure, Chaim Nachum Bialik, 1873 to 1934. He's the grandfather of modern Hebrew literature. Isaac Bezhevitz Singer, Nobel Prize winner, 1908 to 1991. These were all people who came out of this, raised religious, with a very strong, which is why when you read them you think they're religious, because they just sound like Bubby and Zadie from the old country. But it was an attempt to create this culture that would be more like combining Jewish with Slavic and will be accepted. Many of these people, by the way, are going to give up on it when they see it doesn't work and get into creating a modern Jewish culture, a Hebrew culture, so to speak. When we talk about Zionism and the rebirth of secular Israeli culture, we'll see that a lot of these people are the leading intellectuals. They start out as miskilim, and they end up being disillusioned by it and just moving into socialism or communism or Bundism or Jewish communist nationalistic Zionistic movements and things like that. But these people like Max Lilienthal, et cetera, were people who initially were very involved in trying to dismantle the traditional Jewish world and bring the Jews into modernity. So it's an internal threat also. Yeah. These are all in Russian-controlled territory. Because in the 18th century, Poland is partitioned. Poland's going to be partitioned between Russia, Austro-Hungary, and Germany. Okay, it's going to cease to exist as an independent country. It will come back into existence, and then, you know, for World War I, it's going to be an independent country again, and then it's going to be gobbled up again by Molotov and during the pact that Russia is going to make with Germany on the eve of World War II. And then it's going to come back to existence again, and it's going to be gobbled up in the Warsaw Pact, and it's going to come back to existence again when communism falls. Poles have a really rough time. I have to admit, I don't feel too sorry for them, but they have a rough time in terms of their nationalist aspirations. For when? All the major programs are happening in the last, more or less in the last 20 years of the, after the assassination of Alexander II in 1881, up until the very early 19th century, we're talking about close to 300 programs. I think it's 284 is the number. Now, what it's going to do, so we have the community, just to sum up, the community falling apart from within, although not everyone's assimilating. When the Nazis, unfortunately, march into Eastern Europe, they're going to find a huge population of still religious Jews there. Okay? But a lot of assimilation. Okay, people running out. Impoverization, ghettoization. And once you get to explosion of violence, many of the Jews decide, that's it, we've got to get out of here. And you're going to have a mass immigration of Jews out of Russia. We're talking about between 1881 and 1914, we're talking about 50,000, 60,000 Jews start leaving every year. 2.5 million Jews are going to emigrate out of Russia from 1881 till about 1914. Okay, which the population, by the way, is going to stay at 5 million Jews, still 40%. Why? Because of the birth rate is going to be very high. But rather than growing to 7, 8 million Jews, whatever, a good percentage of the population is going to pack up and leave. Where are they going to go? They're going to go mostly to North America. America is going to absorb over close to 2.5 million Jewish immigrants during this period of time. One of the largest waves of immigration into America is going to be Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. That's the story of our great-grandparents. Or your great-great-grandparents. Sorry? Exactly, Ellis Island. Go see this movie, Hester Street, which is a little, not a big-budget movie that came out about 20 years ago. Great movie, showing about the interaction between the different waves of immigration. What do they find, these Jews? And we're going to talk about America in a minute, but what do they find, not this class, but what happens in America? When they come to America, they don't find, like in the Babylonian exile, when the 10,000 best and brightest Jews are exiled 11 years prior to the destruction of the first temple. They get there and they find the Jewish infrastructure is intact. The day schools and the yeshivas and the pizza seller and the kosher pizza guy and the bagel guy and the herrings and the pickle guy, they're all there. They find about 250,000, 280,000 assimilated German Jews. And they're going to all lose it. Almost all these Jews are going to come to America and assimilate. And this is what happens. The tremendous dislocation of the Jewish community of Eastern Europe is a big disaster within Eastern Europe for the Jewish community, and spiritually it's actually, physically it might be a butt safer for Jews in America, but spiritually it is the largest mass assimilation of Jews in Jewish history, which is why many of the people in Poland would not let their children go to America. The Golden of Medina was called, the Golden Land. Why? Because it was a place where you're going to lose it. My great-great-grandmother, Hanna Temekasowicz from Lomża, Poland, brought some of her kids back from America to Europe, because she was afraid they were going to go off. The ones who stayed all went off. The ones who stayed in America went off. The ones who came back to Poland all died in the Holocaust. So it was a lose-lose situation in many respects for the Jews, ultimately, in hindsight. Okay, I want to stop now with that. This is Thursday. We're not getting any more classes this week. Next week we're finishing off. We have four more classes. Next week I'm going to talk about